Hello, sex fans, and welcome back. Today is Wednesday, December 8th, 2010, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge.
Oh, Archie. Oh, Archie.
I'm so glad that you're enjoying yourself, but I'm not Archie. I am your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. Guess what? Brad Warner, Zen monk, author of Sex, Sin, and Zen, a Buddhist exploration of sex from celibacy to polyamory and everything in between, punk rocker and filmmaker, returns this week for part two of our conversation. It's a pleasure to have him back for another dose of his unique brand of sex wisdom. I suppose you've already listened to part one of this exceptional conversation, right? It appeared here last week at this time, don't you know? Good, because I don't want you to miss out on any of this. But if by chance you did miss last week's show, don't worry. It and all of my podcasts are in the podcast archive on my site, drdicksexadvice.com. All you gotta do is use the search function in the header, type in podcast number 248, and presto! But don't forget to use the pound sign when you do your search.
Kiss me there.
Alrighty then. Well, that's gonna have to wait until after the show. For more of Brad and his marvelous and insightful writing, visit him on his website, hardcorezen.blogspot.com. Today's podcast is once again brought to you by the granddaddies of male masturbation toys, the amazing Fleshlight and Fleshjack. For those of you who have never seen one of these brilliant devices, let me describe it to you. It looks like a huge flashlight. Thus, the very clever names, don't you know? Inside the durable plastic case, there is a soft, fleshy inside called Super Skin. And trust me, this stuff is aptly named. It is phenomenal. But that's just the beginning. What makes the Fleshlight and Fleshjack so freaking amazing is that you get to design and personalize just about every aspect of the unit you purchase. Now, what other toy company allows you to do that?
Is there any danger?
No, there's no danger. And ladies, here's a tip. This is the perfect gift for your man. You know how I keep talking about the mutual joys and important information shared when a couple masturbates together, right? Well, this is the ideal masturbation toy for him. Check it out and see for yourself. I know you will agree. Nothing beats a Fleshlight. Look for the banner in the sidebar of drdicksexadvice.com. You'll be so glad you did. Okay, on with the show. Brad Warner, welcome back and thank you again for joining us. I sure appreciate you spending more time with us. I'm still fascinated by the conversation that we had last week, and I want to pick up precisely where we left off, if that's okay with you. Good. So
yep.
we were talking about fixed notions of ourself and how that sometimes cuts us off from, you know, the other influences in our lives that could actually have some benefit. I want to move on to an area also that seems to be so problematic for people of religion. And so much of Western spiritual tradition is shame-based, particularly when it comes to human sexuality. Sex equals sin. But there's got to be a better way than that. And I assume that you would agree that with me that there can be a happy marriage between sexuality and spirituality, right?
Well, I think so, yeah. The book is actually now called Sex, Sin, and Zen, but the original title was Sin, Sex, and Zen.
Ah.
And so the reason I put the word sin in the title is because I figure that, and I wanted to put it as the first word, but, you know, they thought sex would spell better. Sex is where it is, okay. But the reason sin is important is because that's, I think, the key to the difference between Buddhist view of sexuality and the Judeo-Christian Islamic view of sexuality, which is that there's no concept of sin. There's no, the concept of sin has been really hard for me to understand, because in the first instance, I realized a few years ago or several years ago that I believed in sin, even though I was not raised in any sort of religious tradition. It's just
hard
part
to
of
escape,
your
escape, isn't it?
Yeah, it's part of part of the atmosphere of growing up in the United States. You believe in sin.
It's
and
sinfully delicious, even.
Yeah. And I found this kind of funny that I had no conscious belief in it, but I had a kind of an unconscious belief in it. But sin seems to me the idea that, all right, there are things that are called sinful which make sense. You know, don't lie, don't kill, don't steal your neighbor's oxen or whatever it says in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And these things make sense. But then there are other categories of things that are biblically considered sinful that don't make any real sense. You know, they you know, masturbation, well, you know, depending on your reading of the Bible, I've read arguments that say otherwise, but a lot of people take the Bible to say masturbation is sinful, sex before marriage is sinful, sex itself is sinful. That doesn't make much sense to you when you look at it. So you develop this idea, I think, this maybe unconscious idea, that God is out there somewhere with a rule book that you're not really allowed to see, and that there are things you might be doing that feel perfectly normal that turn out later on to be sinful. So you have a lot of, I think, if you're raised in that background, or even if you're me and weren't raised in that background, but you kind of find that you have a deep belief in it somewhere in the back of your head, then you have a lot of anxiety, because you don't know what's a sin and what's not.
Exactly.
And in Buddhism, there's no idea of this God who watches over us and decides what's good or bad. There's an idea which is actually very difficult, if you think about it or if you look at it at all, which is that we know innately what is right and what is wrong action. And one of the ideas of doing the Zazen practice is to learn to become quiet enough, and I don't mean by quieting your mind or stilling your mind or anything, but just become able to penetrate through all of the things that your mind tosses up at you to the point where you are able to understand intuitively what right action is at any given moment.
You know, in Christianity, at least, you know, it's the whole notion of conscience, and, you know, one must follow one's conscience, even if it's contrary to, like, church teachings and stuff like that. So the church, of course, doesn't talk about that all that much, because that would kind of liberate folks from, you know, following the precepts, but it's the basic tenet of Christianity is that conscience is primary. And that's
your only
connection with God, basically.
Actually, that's not too different from the Buddhist notion. You know, like I said, I think in the first part of the interview that I feel now that there's a lot more to Christianity than the Christianity I was exposed to when
really?
I was young.
Oh, I agree.
But
some people claim that the last real Christian died on the cross, and I tend to agree.
Yeah, well, that may be true. But I think there's a lot more depth there than I was when I was younger, than I gave it credit for when I was younger. But the Christianity I was exposed to was more about, you know, this unseen, horrible dad at the sky who decided what was right and what was wrong. And Buddhism, we don't really talk in terms of the word conscience doesn't really come up, but it's the same sort of idea that there's some kind of innate quality in every human being that allows that person to know what to do, which is a hard notion, because we're always, you know, going, well, you know, I don't think that guy knows what to do. And, you know, you can get very, very deluded and very, very fooled by your mind to the point where it becomes extremely difficult to know what to do at any given moment. That's definitely true.
Right.
And that's why we do this hard practice all the time.
So if I'm not mistaken, Zen is a pretty individualistic approach to enlightenment, which is so different from the Judaic, Islamic, Christian traditions. If this is the case, what do you make of all the questions students of Zen seem to have about what they should, could, and should not do in terms of sexual behaviors or feelings or right practices?
Well, yeah, in a sense it is individualistic because you're sitting mostly, if you're doing the Zazen practice, you're sitting most of the time by yourself and with yourself. Mm-hmm. So in that sense it is. It's also a communal practice because you have a teacher and you have usually you have a community of fellow practitioners that you're working with. So when people bring up questions about what is right and wrong behavior, it isn't really up to me to decide, you know, or up to a teacher of Buddhism to decide for the student what is right and what is wrong. And that was actually kind of frustrating when I'd come up with these kind of questions to my teachers, you know, especially sometimes in terms of sex. And it usually would be kind of thrown back at me, like, well, what do you think is right? You know, which is like, no, I want you to tell me. But the idea is, we all have to make our own way for ourselves, and ultimately that's what we're going to do anyway. Whether we have advice from our spiritual leaders or not, we're still going to make our own decisions. Mm-hmm. So why not just cut out the middleman and just say, okay, what this practice is about is you learning how to control yourself rather than you learning to submit to some organization's idea of what you should be.
Right. So you asked the eternal question, so to speak, in your second chapter of your book, are Buddhists allowed to jack off? I love it. You really get off on sticking your finger in the eye of scrupulous religiosity, don't you?
Well, it's fun, you know. it's fun to get a rise out of that side of of those kind of people. But, you know, it's funny. I just came across a review of Sex in and Zen, which was saying how conservative the reviewer thought I was, which
no
I thought
kidding.
Was funny.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I get it from both sides. But, yeah, it's... But I think these are legitimate questions, you know, because we are told... Well, you know, Christianity is kind of coming out of that, but for most of the... Well, for a good deal of the 20th century, there was an idea that masturbation was wrong and was evil. And in Buddhism, you do have an idea that the monks in the early days were not allowed to masturbate. Mm-hmm. But I believe that this was more something that was done to keep... I mean, these were men, because the earliest tradition was all men, and they were living together, sleeping in one big room side by side, and I feel like the rules against masturbation were more about social decorum than about anything, any idea that masturbation was evil.
Oh, interesting. That's interesting.
But still, you know, there was a rule against masturbation. These days, I don't think most Buddhists really pay much attention to the anti-masturbation rule, but I could be wrong. There could be some
a lot of Christians don't pay attention to it either, but it's still on the books, and you know, very strongly so. And you know, in the Christian tradition, it's all about this. There is no legitimate. We talked about this a little bit last week. There is no legitimate sexual expression outside the confines of marriage, and all sexual acts must be open to procreation. And so wasting one's seed or spilling one's seed on the ground or in a tissue, for that matter, is a real bad thing because you are flying in the face of God's will for humankind, which, you know, just makes, the simple act of self-pleasuring, you know, just this loathsome sort of thing when you're frustrating God's plan. Isn't it terrible? Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, every sperm is sacred, right?
That's exactly like Monty Python says.
Yeah.
So much of what I know, or I think I know about Buddhism, is about detachment. But so much of what people are looking for in sexuality is territorial, at least almost to the point of ownership. She's my wife. He's my husband. What's up with that, do you suppose?
Well, I mean, this gets into a whole big issue, because this actually came up last week. I was giving a talk in Montreal, and I didn't say anything about detachment or non-attachment, and a guy came at the end of the talk with the Q&A saying, well, you're talking about detachment, and I believe that people need to have attachment to others. And I said, no, I'm not, you know, I didn't say anything about detachment. But there's a strong kind of idea. When people hear, in Buddhism, there is an idea, a very strong and very important idea of non-attachment. Mm-hmm. But people hear that phrase, non-attachment, and we should probably get rid of it. Mm-hmm. Because they misunderstand it to mean detachment, like we are supposed to be aloof and unto ourselves, an island unto ourselves, yeah. And caring for nobody, loving nobody, and just, you know, floating out there in the cosmos. But that's, if you think about it even for a couple of seconds, that's totally contrary to the entire Buddhist notion of what the universe is, which is a kind of a oneness where everybody is fundamentally attached to everyone else. So we have this idea that we are all one organism, you know, and that the separation we believe we see very clearly is a kind of an illusion. It's a useful illusion, and it's what keeps you from using my credit card and things like that. But it's ultimately falls apart at some level. Mm-hmm. You know, and we can even see this scientifically. If you try to, you know, if I put my hand on this chair that I'm sitting in, and then you looked at it through an electron microscope, it would be very difficult to find the place where my hand ends and the chair begins. We're all sort of a continuum. That's mm-hmm. that's, you know, an actual kind of a provable fact these days. But then when you're talking about ownership or possession, that's where you're talking about where you're getting into something that non-attachment can address, because you can't really own somebody. You can't, because that concept of ownership presupposes this idea that there are two independent entities that can be fused together, or at least chained together, and not ever come apart. And that just isn't the way the universe works. The universe is constantly changing and revising itself. So even though we are fundamentally attached or part of everything, we're also in this kind of flow. So we shouldn't get the idea of permanence. So what we're talking about in non-attachment is more this idea of that things are one way, and that they should and must stay that way forever, because that's just not going to happen.
Right, exactly. When asked if your book was a sex manual, you replied, there aren't any sex secrets of the Zen masters. I believe that there are a couple of cheesy sex manuals out there with Zen in the title, but I didn't think the world needed another one of those. Someone asked me if Zen practitioners do it in a special way. Not as far as I know, though you may be able to find some people like that. I suppose it's more that the Zen approach to sex is like the Zen approach to the rest of life. We try to be as fully present in every situation as possible. I think that's absolutely marvelous, because being present is what really it's all about, to my mind.
Yeah. Yeah, and as far as that Zen, you know, secrets of the Zen masters, sex secrets of the Zen masters, if there's anything, it's that view of allowing things to be as they are. And I really think that can be very powerful, because I think a lot of, when people are talking about sexual dysfunction, a lot of it kind of goes into this idea of attachment. It's like thinking things ought to be this way, yeah. And they aren't, and oh my God, and then all of a sudden you've lost your erection and everything's horrible.
Right. Or that, you know, I am so concerned about losing my erection that I'm not present to the,
yeah.
The joyful sensuality that is invading my body.
Yeah, yeah, and so if there's anything you can learn in as far as sex technique from Zen Buddhism, it's this idea of just letting go of what you think things ought to be and just getting on with what they actually are, you know. And if you lose your erection, you still got your mouth and your hands, and there's all kinds of things you can do,
exactly.
You know. So that's as far as we can go with the, but then there's a, you know, people, hear about tantric Buddhism, which I don't know too much about. It's part of the Tibetan tradition, which tries to use sex as a kind of meditation. But I think people misuse that a lot because they get... The sexual side of Tantra was something you weren't even supposed to enter into until you'd practiced the meditation side of it for years. Mm-hmm. So these
like
kind of manuals...
skipping to third base before you,
right,
hit
right,
first
yeah.
base. I love
right,
it.
Right, that's exactly... good metaphor. Yeah. So so what you're doing is trying to skip over all the difficult part and get to the fun stuff. And but the difficult part is essential. So these books that are telling you to jump right into the tantric sort of sexuality, it's not really going to work.
Yeah.
So there's sort of a kind of a large movement of people who are, I think, fooling themselves into thinking they're being really meditative when all they're doing is kind of getting off more efficiently. No, maybe that's okay, but still, don't call it meditative.
Alrighty. So since the subtitle to your book is A Buddhist Exploration of Sex from Celibacy to Polyamory and Everything in Between, let's talk about some of the stuff that is in between those two things.
Sure.
In the time that we have left. So let's talk about porn. Is there a place for porn in a Zen worldview?
Well, I got a lot of heat because I write for a website called Suicide Girls,
yes,
which is kind of considered by many people to be porn, although the people who run Suicide Girls don't like to use that word. It's very sort of soft as far as, you know, porn goes. But yeah, so people were kind of upset about that. I feel like if you go back to the ancient Buddhism, like Dogen, who was the founder of the sect that I practice in 800 years ago, he wrote some things about don't look at pornography, and what exactly constituted pornography 800 years ago in Japan is kind of open to a certain amount of debate. Actually, some of it was pretty juicy, they're finding out.
Yes.
Nowadays, as they're examining these old woodcuts and stuff. But that was in his time, and now we're in a different time where pornography is something that's almost impossible to avoid, or at least things that would have been labeled pornography in our past are kind of commonplace now. So we have to learn to live in the world that we actually live in, rather than an idealized world of the past. So if pornography becomes a problem, then that's a problem.
But it's a problem because of how I consume it, not necessarily it's a problem in and of itself. Is that
yeah, that's exactly right, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so it's what you're doing with it that's the problem rather than what it is. So it's not like it's a sin to look at a picture of a naked lady or a naked man. It's just that you know, it's problematic when you get too addicted to anything.
Right.
So that's... You know, it's kind of changed. The internet has really changed human life, and we're only just coming to terms with that. And one of the things which I wrote about in the book was, you know, I was thinking about when I was a kid, it was actually a big deal to get a hold of a piece of pornography. You know, it was almost like making a drug deal. You know, you had to know somebody who could get it, who was willing to sell it to you, all this stuff. And I was talking to my nephew, who's 20 now, and he, you know, for him, all of his life as a sexually awakened human being, all he had to do to get a piece of porn was to go on his dad's computer and type out P-O-R-N, enter.
I know, and it floods.
And he gets it, yeah, and it floods right in. You know, and it says, are you 18? Yes.
Because... I am.
Right now there's an 8-year-old going, are you 18? Yes.
Absolutely.
So there's probably 10,000 8-year-olds clicking that yes button right now. So that's really changed the world we live in terms of sexuality and in terms of what we're exposed to. And it's not going to go away, you know, barring the... total collapse of Western civilization, which I suppose, you know, is always a possibility, but let's hope a remote possibility. You know, that's going to be the only thing that would change the availability of pornography. And so we have to live in a society where this stuff is widely available. And the question is, isn't how do we eliminate it or how do we stamp it out. It's well, okay, here it is. Here it's part of the environment. What are we going to? How are we going to respond to it? And I think that's the key thing. How are we going to make pornography better and more conscientious and less exploitative and so on and so forth? And how are we going to deal with it without becoming addicted to it?
How brilliant. So let's talk about sex toys. Of course, I'm dying to interject a snide comment here about what a Zen sex toy might look like, but I'm going to try to rise above my snark. Do tell, what are your thoughts about sex toys?
Well, I don't have any great opinions about them one way or another. You know, I was actually one of the things an article I pitched to Suicide Girls, which they didn't pick up on, and I was kind of sad, was I came across this group of people in, where were they? They were in Minnesota. I think they're based in either Minneapolis or St. Paul, who were trying to make the sex toy industry more conscientious by selling only, because apparently there's no regulations for the kind
none.
Of materials.
Absolutely.
So these people were actually going out and testing the materials and making sure that the sex toys that they were selling weren't going to dissolve inside of somebody's body, apparently...
Or be a cancer-inducing agent.
Sure. There's all kinds of terrible things.
Oh, it's terrible. Absolutely terrible.
And the only sort of really strong thoughts I felt about that is that there should be some kind of regulation on that, especially because these things are so widely used.
Yes.
You know, and I just read that book, Sex at Dawn, which mentions that I think it was among the first five things that were patented, electronic devices
that were patented,
the vibrator.
And for you know for the healing of women's sexual issues, interestingly enough.
Yeah. So, but I don't think there's any inherent evil in using them, and I don't know what a Buddhist sex toy would look like. Maybe me. I don't know.
I love it. I love it. Let's see. Let's talk about polyamory a little bit. I would think that exclusivity of any sort is decidedly un-Zen, but I'm not sure I'm right on that after the discussion we've been having. And so if it is, what does that say about our capacity for relationships? Does it open us up to the possibility of fuller, bigger, larger?
Well, I think if you're in a relationship where you've agreed upon exclusivity, there's good reason to honor that agreement. So,
absolutely.
And when I first came across the term polyamory, I think I was married when I first heard it, and I didn't really understand it. It seemed to be just a new way of saying sleeping around. But I've done a little bit research, and I think it goes beyond that. But at the same time, I'm still a little skeptical. I've run into people, particularly Nina Hartley, who I interviewed in the book, who's a porn star, who was raised in a Buddhist household, which I think is very interesting. You know, she seems to be able to practice polyamory, and it works for her.
Mm-hmm.
And if it works for the people it works for, then there's no great sin in it. And you know, I've come to kind of accept that it's probably true that human beings, you know, I've been waffling back and forth on this. I think in my first book I expressed the very common notion that human beings are sort of naturally monogamous. But now I'm starting to wonder if that's true at all.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what we are naturally isn't so much the question as, you know, it always goes back to me, to what is the situation we're living in now.
Right.
And we have to learn to deal with that. And I think if we're going to create a society where things like polyamory are going to be acceptable, then, okay, we got to learn to deal with that. To me, it seems like a way to introduce a certain level of tension and confusion in your life if you're not really built that way.
Right.
But on the other hand, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, and certainly if it works, then go for it. It's not. But be honest. I would say, you know, I've had this conversation with a few people who've asked me about their polyamorous relationships, and I say the most important thing is to be honest with yourself, to the point where you have to say, okay, is this, maybe this isn't working. You know, maybe I am feeling jealous and,
yes,
and possessive and all of this. And instead of, you know, when you find yourself feeling jealous and possessive, you can have the intellectual understanding that jealousy and possessiveness are not right, but that doesn't necessarily make them go away. So you still have to deal with it.
And it has absolutely nothing to do necessarily with sexuality. I mean, I can feel, you know, yeah, envious and jealous about, you know, how, you know, other people live in the world and, you know, that I don't have what they have and how come,
sure,
it's easier for them and, you know, I'm, you know, stuck here in a rut and, you know, all of those kinds of things. Those are natural human feelings that for good or for worse, you know, abound. And, you know, sometimes they're attached to sexual feelings or feelings of involved with relationships and stuff like that. But that doesn't necessarily mean, at least to my mind, that, you know, we are built one way or another. And because, I mean, jealousy is a big part of sexually exclusive relationships as well,
yeah,
as difficulties that are found in polyamorous ones.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole, you know, the whole idea of the burqa is to hide our eyes from things that make us envious, right?
Right.
But then, you know, I said this in the book, if you're going
to
go that way, then if you have a nice, you know, if you have a brand new Cadillac car, you should put a big burlap sack over that when you're driving around.
Exactly.
So that nobody will be jealous of that.
Exactly.
Or put a big burlap sack for your house so nobody,
exactly,
gets jealous of your house.
Right.
You know, it's a skewed perspective.
Exactly. And with that, sir, I must acknowledge again that our time is up, and I could go on and on because you are so charming and so informative and very interesting, and thank you so much for so much of your precious time. But before we conclude, would you give us your website address and walk us around a bit?
Yeah, I keep a blog, which is hardcorezen.blogspot.com. So hardcorezen is one word, .blogspot.com. And actually, if you just look up Hardcore Zen on Google, I think it's the first thing that comes up, which is nice. And that has links to everything else you'd ever want to know about little old, maybe a little bit too much stuff. But you can find the links to the books and to other articles I've done and all kinds of stuff.
Well, thank you so much again. And until we speak again, we will be seeing you in cyberspace.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad. Be well.
You too.
Bye now. Great show, huh? Well, that's it for today, sex fans. I'm so glad you could join me. Tune in next week for more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is the fabulous Fleshlight and Fleshjack. You know, all you guys out there who keep complaining to me about your short fuse, well, here's a tip for you. Being a great lover, being able to control your orgasmic response, and last for as long as you like, takes practice. Sure, you can learn to last longer by simply using your hand, but now there is an even more effective way to train yourself for sexual stamina and endurance with a partner.
But isn't it a secret?
I guess it is, but I'm going to spill the beans anyhow. Allow me to introduce you to the Endurance Jack. It is just one of the fine designs from Fleshlight. It comes with a stamina insert, which has extra large bumps and a tight canal. With just a little practice with this puppy, you'll be able to last longer, gain control over your ejaculatory response, and avoid untimely climax. Once you've accomplished this with an Endurance Jack, you will have all the skills you need to last and last with a partner. And remember, these fine products are made in the good old U.S. of A. Look for the Flesh Jack banner right there in the sidebar of DrDickSexAdvice.com.
But why are you telling everyone?
Because I want you to know. Speaking of sex toys, I want to take a moment to invite you to check out my adult products review site called DrDickSexToyReviews.com. That's right, sex fans. Now you can see what's hot and what's not in adult products. You can even find our reviews of several Fleshlight products. You'll find reviews of all sorts of adult goodies, sex toys for sure, but also condoms, lubes, herbal products, fetish gear, as well as educational and enrichment videos. Don't miss a single one. Again, the address is drdicksextoyreviews.com. Until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.